It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk to the chair of a new state task force on Alzheimer's and dementia prevention in Wisconsin.
First, Governor Walker's campaign has taken a couple of blows over the last couple days. Two new polls show a dip in support for Governor Walker in Iowa. The Des Moines Register Bloomberg Politics Iowa poll released Saturday shows Governor Walker in third place in the state. And the Monmouth University poll out today shows Walker in fifth place. He was in first place in that poll in July.
Matthew DeFore is with us to break down the latest on Governor Walker's campaign. He's a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, so how far is Governor Walker slipping in the polls so far?
Well, we're talking about Iowa. I mean, it's been a pretty tumultuous month for Governor Walker. The Monmouth poll that you mentioned, he was at 22% in the poll they did in July, shortly after he launched his presidential campaign. And so now he's down at 7% in that exact same poll, going from first place to fifth. The Des Moines Register poll, their last poll was in May, where he was at 17%, also in first place. And now he's down to 8%, so it's a very similar story. He is clearly the wheels are not moving in the right direction.
So we've been hearing for the past several months now that part of the strategy here was that he's got to take Iowa, and that seemed to be an easy get in the beginning. So how important is Iowa to Governor Walker's future campaign?
Well, when you talk to people who are close to his campaign, it's not as if they're putting all their eggs in the Iowa basket. They have a long-term strategy. They want to, perform well, obviously, in Iowa. They talk about, doing well, not necessarily we have to win it. But it's going to be interesting to see the media narrative if he comes in third place or fifth place even in Iowa, after the February 1st Iowa caucus. I mean, if he doesn't win, that's going to be the story. But the thing is, with him dropping so much now, if he does win, it might actually be a bigger boost than if he was coming in, leading or in the top two in the polls and then falling and doing as expected. So it may actually benefit him to, in terms of the expectations game, if he can pull it together and can end up coming out, first or second. But yeah, it's going to be important for his momentum. For sure.
So obviously there's different opinions at play here, but is there any sort of consensus emerging about what's behind the loss of support?
You see this narrative about the Donald Trump factor, and that's really what we've been hearing a lot of, is that he's soaking up a lot of Scott Walker's potential support. But then you also look at Ben Carson's surge in the polls. In the Des Moines Register poll, they were very close. I think in one of the two polls that Ben Carson is tied with Donald Trump. So he's sort of come out of almost nowhere to where you might see the narrative focus a lot on why somebody like Ben Carson's doing so well. And it's the same story. People are looking for somebody who is a fresh face, who's not a Washington insider. Governor Walker has been talking about how he's somebody who's tested, but people are looking for somebody who's not a career politician, and perhaps he's certainly been a politician his entire career, so people may be looking at that with less favor than they were, or at least when they're looking right now at Donald Trump or Ben Carson or Carly Fiorina, for that matter.
Now, one thing that some political observers have said is that the Scott Walker that they're seeing on the stump is not the same Scott Walker that began the race, that drew people in. You've been following this. You've been watching him. Are you seeing a different Scott Walker now than you saw in the beginning?
Well, it's not a different Scott Walker than the one you might see on the campaign trail in Wisconsin. When he came out at the Iowa Freedom Summit in January, there was certainly something that a lot of national commentators were saying, oh, this is a different Scott Walker. There was something to that at the time where his energy level was a bit higher. He was telling some stories that we actually dug into. He had this line about, these threats against his family and, someone wanting to gut his wife like a deer. And we looked into that and we couldn't find that threat was something that they were able to provide evidence of. And so he stopped using that on the stump. And, I don't know if it's he kind of comes out forcefully with one thing and then seems forced to be pulled back a little bit. And so he's just been kind of oscillating between, trying to be the sort of passionate, big time, kind of Trumpian sort of politician that I think he senses the people want, But, you know, he's not necessarily, he doesn't necessarily just have that fire in his belly. And so it's kind of, he's being kind of pushed off of his typical game, perhaps.
We're talking right now with Matthew DeFore, state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about the latest on Governor Walker's campaign for president in 2016. Now, you're talking about maybe the Trump factor here and that Scott Walker maybe moved into directions he wouldn't normally go. And one critique is that maybe he's moving to the right to try to capture some of those voters farther to the right, maybe than he might have gone without that pressure. Do you see any reason to believe that that might be the case?
Yeah, he's certainly having trouble finding his footing, especially on this immigration issue. He gets asked about it a lot, and he clearly doesn't want to be focusing on it. But whenever he gets asked about it, it seems like he doesn't have a clear idea of what he wants to say. Just as recently as Sunday, you know, he was asked about whether there should be a wall built on the Canadian border, and he said that it's after talking to people in New Hampshire, he thinks it's a legitimate issue, but that's been roundly criticized today, and we're seeing blowback on that. He was recently, you know, getting tripped up about whether to get rid of birthright citizenship, which is part of the 14th Amendment. So, yeah, he doesn't seem to want to talk about it. This isn't an issue that he's real strong on, obviously not having dealt with it as a governor, but it's certainly been tripping him up lately.
A piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel yesterday by Craig Gilbert looked closely at poll numbers from inside Wisconsin, and Gilbert found that in-state support for the governor is slipping here, too. Do you have a sense of how Governor Walker is being perceived in Wisconsin right now?
Yeah, there was a great piece by Craig. He mentioned that how independents in the state, his support among independents had dropped from, I think, 43% approval to 24%. Even GOP-leaning independents dropped from 83% to 69%. And so, you know, is that a factor of, or a function of his running for president? Are people unhappy about that? Are they unhappy with the latest state budget? There's a number of different things that could be affecting those numbers. And, yeah, we'll just have to see how that plays out. I think his pollster, Ed Goetz, has talked about how the further away you get from the budget and all the negative headlines there, you'll see his numbers come back. But, you know, so far that hasn't been the case, and we'll see what happens in the next Marquette poll.
And you've said that historically August hasn't been a great month for Midwestern governors running for president. Is there a pattern here that Governor Walker is part of?
Well, it was funny because about 2 months ago, we were all talking about how the end of the Iowa straw poll in Ames in early August was going to be a boon for the governor because he wouldn't have to play so much there. Governor Tommy Thompson, when he ran for president back in 2007 and 2008, he exited the race in August of 2007 after coming in sixth place in the Iowa straw poll. And so it was seen as, you know, and then not a Wisconsin governor, but Tim Pawlenty in 2011, the same thing happened. He showed poorly there. And so the fact that Governor Walker didn't have to bring out all of his supporters to that event, potentially coming in, a lower than first place, which, again, may have, you know, if it had happened this time around, it might, you know, who knows if Donald Trump or Ben Carson would have gotten more support than Scott Walker there. His campaign might have been in shambles at this point. But, it was not a good month for Scott Walker, and it wasn't a good month for Tommy Thompson 8 years ago. But unlike Tommy, Governor Walker gets to move on. So
now there have been calls among supporters. We heard about this a bit in the Washington Post recently. Supporters, some of them at least, calling for a reboot of the campaign, a return to more basics that Scott Walker is strong in, things like the Act 10 law and things like that, the budget that went through. Are we going to see that, do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's going to be doing a series of policy speeches. He did one on the Affordable Care Act. He did one last week at the Citadel in South Carolina on foreign policy. His supporters are really, I think, excited about his policy positions. They think he's a very savvy politician when it comes to just coming out on the right side of an issue, at least in their view. And, they were really talking up the Iran policy that he's laid out, saying that he will, you know, get rid of that deal on the first day. I think he's on the right side of that one compared to other campaigns like the Bush campaign. And so, yeah, you know, expect to see other things like him talking about tax reform or education or other types of issues in the weeks and months ahead. And then, heading into those crucial early primary states in March of next year, he'll be marking the 5-year anniversary of his, the introduction of his Act 10 reforms. So, yeah, look to see that being a centerpiece of his campaign heading into that stretch.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Matthew DeFore, State Capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us to talk about the latest on Governor Walker's campaign for president for 2016. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as public schools open for the fall, our guest shares ideas for how Wisconsin might be able to close its daunting achievement gap.
First, as growing numbers of Americans cope with dementia and Alzheimer's, a new state task force aims to tackle issues related to prevention, treatment, and care.
Representative Mike Rohrkast of NENA is the chair of the Assembly Speaker's Task Force on Alzheimer's and Dementia. He's a Republican who represents Wisconsin's 55th Assembly District. Representative Rohrkast, welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here, and it's an honor to represent this task force and this issue.
Can you talk about the scope of the problem, why the Assembly is focusing on it with this task force?
Sure. Dementia is something that's affecting a growing number of people. It would affect at least well over 100,000 individuals in the state of Wisconsin. And if you want to put it in perspective, probably one out of every seven individuals that's age in their 60s is affected by dementia. As they get into their 80s and people are living much longer, it goes to actually one in three. So this is becoming a very, very significant issue. And we really want to focus on making sure that we protect both those individuals, their families. We want to focus on care and then look at how we can improve services that are being provided for these individuals.
Right. You mentioned that number of people suffering directly from these diseases, and that you've got to include that number of their families whose lives are very much affected by that. So let's start there. What kind of things are you looking for to help caregivers for people dealing with Alzheimer's and other kinds of dementia?
It's a great question, because what's happening with the graying of the population, you're finding that younger adults are now having to care for their parents, and their parents are showing these signs of dementia. So that's causing stress on their lives. They may be trying to raise kids. They're working. We're going to be looking at how can we help employers help caregivers that are actually working, in most businesses that are affected by this every day. I'm a former human resources person in the private sector, and we were seeing this much more frequently than we had in years. And so that means that companies are going to have to be more sensitive to giving people time off, or at least looking at how they can help those individuals and maybe help them still do their jobs, but help care for their aging parents.
I think a lot of families in this situation, it's this unique thing. They feel like maybe they're alone in this, when in fact, as you say, so many families are affected. Are you looking to try to give a toolkit that everybody can reach out and use here?
Absolutely. I think the Department of Health Services, they've done some really great work already. There's a number of training toolkits that are available to the aging and disability resource centers around the states. So I think I don't mean to minimize it, but a matter of marrying some of these organizations up. So getting DHS and the ADRCs to be going out and being more proactive out in the business world, but also to promote their programs. So I think this task force, we can not only address some legislative issues, we can address some new programs, but I think one of the key things is just increasing awareness and hopefully reducing the stigma about talking about dementia issues. There's still a stigma. People relate dementia to mental health and they don't like to talk about it, but we need to be more open about this.
Now, this is a task force, and as I understand how these things work, a lot of times the first step is listening. Who are you going to gather information, to gather insight on these issues?
First off, this is a bipartisan task force. Representative Diane Hesselbein out of the Middleton area is co-chairing this with me, and we have individuals from both the Republican and the Democratic caucuses on the task force. We will be holding a number of public information sessions around the state. The locations and the timing of those is to be determined. The first step is we're getting, with now the summer over, we're going to get the entire task force together and to bring everybody up to speed from an education standpoint as to, and DHS is going to help us with that, Department of Health Services, Kitty Rhodes and her area will help us with that. And then we're going to start to prioritize and to identify areas to take a look at. Again, I think, and I don't want to be prescriptive to the task force, but it's around protection, training, awareness, and looking at other new programs or ones we can expand.
Talking to Representative Mike Rohrkast of NENA, he's chair of the new Assembly Speaker's Task Force on Alzheimer's and Dementia. You just said the word protection. Let's get into this now. Protecting people, mostly senior citizens, dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, and let me give you an example. And I think one of the reasons that they asked me to head this up is I was working on legislation in this area. Several constituents in the NENA area, which is where I was from, brought an issue to my attention. And it has to do where dementia or Alzheimer's starts to show up in assisted living facilities or CBRFs, the community-based residential facilities. There are certain rules about the disclosure of medications that could be administered to a person with dementia that apply to nursing homes, but don't actually apply to these other organizations. And again, this isn't about prescribing or controlling how doctors do it, but it's more about just ensuring that the family members are aware if there's certain drugs, and some of these are psychotropic type drugs, some heavy duty medications that sometimes are administered to individuals with dementia.
Now, we've heard on this show in the past about a lack of capacity nationwide, anyway, among the homes and centers you've been talking about. There may be a lot of beds at assisted care centers, but not all of these facilities might be ready to deal with Alzheimer's and dementia and the treatment and extra care that those things required. Is that an issue you're looking at on the task force?
It will be, and I think one of the issues, though, is that we will look at is how do we keep these individuals in their homes or in lesser care facilities longer. In talking with a number of individuals in the healthcare profession, including a chief medical officer in the NENA area, he thinks that there's tremendous opportunities for increased home care, particularly for seniors. The more that you can keep them in the home, you can deal with their issues to keep them in a familiar setting. You can also see and potentially prevent something from happening because you can see how they're living their daily life. So that's something that I really want to look at, and I think the task force will be interested in as well.
Programs that like that, at least to get started, sound like they could cost some money for the state up front, at least to get them into gear, maybe year-to-year costs. Is the task force going to look at maybe some kind of budget requests for these kind of programs?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't have a commitment or a dollar amount, but that, I mean, obviously, I think there's going to need to be some funding. But I don't think it has to be a lot. On that issue, this is more of a training and education and let some of these programs start to work their way in. And there's already a lot of good work that's being done, particularly at the local level. So I think with some seed funding, we may be able to develop some programs that can really take off. The other thing that I think is important to remember, if we can do better on the preventative side, we're going to actually save the state, the individual, the family, tremendous cost in the long run.
So let's get into the prevention angle now. I know that's another part of the scope of the task force. What sort of issues are you looking at when it comes to prevention?
I think one of the things, and we're going to use the UW system to help us with research on this, is what are some of the predictors so that we can identify those groups that may be most presupposed to dementia issues, and then look at ways to mitigate that earlier in their life so we can start on treatment programs, because there are some ways to minimize the impact of dementia, but you have to treat it early.
I understand there's some existing legislation, a bill in the legislature that would require hospitals to provide training to caregivers when patients dealing with dementia are discharged. AARP backs this, the Wisconsin Hospital Association against the bill. Will your task force comment on current legislation like that or just look at future recommendations?
I mean, we're still in the process of getting together, but absolutely, we'll take a look at that and try to understand why it was promoted by one organization and there were concerns by another. We'll take a look at it and see if we should move it forward.
A lot of times when we hear issues in our state legislature and around the nation, too, it's Republicans versus Democrats. Is this the kind of thing you expect you're going to find common ground and actually accomplish something when all is said and done?
Well, that's when they asked me to do it. That was my objective. I want to get some results in this. This isn't a partisan issue. I mean, Alzheimer's, dementia, these issues affect everybody, and this is a great example of where I think the state legislature can come and work together. It's an area that I've got passion about. Representative Hesselbein has passion about, and we feel that we can make some progress and help the residents of the state of Wisconsin.
And do you have a timeline when you're hoping to have some recommendations ready to get out on the floor and vote on?
We hope to have these done by the end of the calendar year, so we'll work into the fall and in the early winter, and hopefully bringing any the significant recommendations forward in January, February.
And maybe this is too early, but I'm sure some of our listeners might have insight on this, either in their personal lives or their professional lives. Is there a way that people can reach out to the task force?
Absolutely. We will be having a website up. We don't have it up yet, but we will have a website up, and they can send me comments, Representative Mike Rorcast or Representative Diane Hesselbein. You can look it up on the Wisconsin legislative website, and we would be happy to hear your comments. And if you want to get on my mailing or Representative Hesselbein, I'm sure that would be possible too. I do biweekly updates that I'll be talking about this on a regular basis.
Representative Rorcast, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on this important issue.
That was Representative Mike Rorcast from Neenah. He's the newly appointed chair of the Speaker's Task Force on Alzheimer's and Dementia. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Most schools in the Milwaukee area are kicking off their fall semester this week. This includes Milwaukee Public Schools, which has been in the headlines lately for its shrinking teacher numbers. And the year begins with a new state budget, which allocates no new spending on public schools in the first year and a small boost in funding in the second year.
The school year for Milwaukee, the state's largest public school district, began with a rally for teachers who are working with administrators to help close the achievement gap in the city. In the past year, a report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation placed Wisconsin worst among the 50 states for racial disparities in education outcomes. And the Civil Rights Project from the University of California, Los Angeles, found Wisconsin high schools suspend black children at a higher rate than any other state.
Dakota Irby joins us now. He's assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Last year, he spoke with a group of Wisconsin superintendents about his experiences as an African-American kid going through various school systems, public and private. He joins us now to talk about the achievement gap in Wisconsin's public schools and what might work to improve it. Dakota, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, you're a professor at the University of Illinois now, but you still do most of your work in Wisconsin. With the challenges out there for Milwaukee public schools, what do you think the top priority should be to get kids off to the best start possible?
Well, I think, you know, some of them you mentioned in the introduction to the segment. I mean, funding is a huge issue. You know, we're in at a time, you know, in a state, in a city where we just allocated quite a bit of money to a public, privately held arena and sports team at the expense of public schools that are in dire need of teachers in a district where a disproportionate number of students are identified as special needs, or roughly 20%. So a lot of it has to do with resources. And then the other piece has quite a bit to do with things that teachers can be doing. I tend to try to focus a lot on what's within the locus of control of educators. And so I guess how I would answer that question would depend on who that audience is. So the response to policymakers or the teachers or the parents would be very different based on what their sphere of influence actually is.
Now, I know you talk about this from the policy angle. That's your field of expertise. But this is also something that you've been talking about from a first-person experience, you yourself being an African-American kid in schools, public and private schools. And last year, you spoke to a group of state superintendents. What did you want them to know about what your school experience was like for you?
Well, the reason that I actually started to talk about my personal experience more is that, as you indicated, I talk a lot about policy and understand numbers and statistics and those sorts of things. And I went through a leadership training program that really helped me to realize that to make all of that matter requires that people understand experiences and people's stories and those sorts of things. So I spent my time with those superintendents from the greater Milwaukee region really just talking about my relationships with teachers, my relationships with adults in my life who really you know, pushed me to excel, even in ways that I didn't imagine for myself. And so one of the, you know, what I like to call it is an emphasis or focus on relational resources. So we could talk about financial resources, there's curricular resources and those sorts of things, but relationships are also fundamental to how young people experience schools. And it was fundamental to how I experienced school, both positive as well as kind of negative relationships that I experienced going through school.
So what kind of relationships made a positive difference in your life?
Well, Lisa Delpit, scholar Lisa Delpit, and several other scholars call people who are kind of firm, have very high expectations in terms of academics, but also are nurturers. They call them warm demanders. And I think that those people who are warm demanders played the most influential role in, you know, my schooling experiences. So when I talk to folks, I talk about my middle school principal, Mr. Cotton. I talk about my history teacher, Ms. Willoughby, my guidance counselor, Ms. Gregory. And so I talk about these folks, and I really try to get down to the minute detail of what were the things that they actually did, what were the things that they actually would say to me that made a difference. I also talk about my mom. She was a warm demander. So these are people who are able to strike a good balance between very high expectations, academic rigor, but also being willing to provide, number one, the support in terms of being able to perform academically and help students learn so they're masters at what their craft, at what they do. But they also have this very kind of difficult to really describe, but there's something about their cultural competence and their ability to relate to young people and to students in a way that helps young people feel valued in the sense of dignity in the education process. And so I spend time talking with them about that because those are the things that are squarely within the sphere of influence of the educators and the leaders who encounter students on a daily basis.
Now you're talking about these warm demanders, and you're also, as you said, a statistics guy, a policy guy. Are there statistics and data to back up that idea that these warm demanders who can nurture and approach from that angle and yet still demand things, that works?
Right. Well, there is and there is not, right? Because a lot of what we see in terms of the statistics and the data that we have that's accessible depends on what people feel is important and what data is collected. So we don't have a lot of data, but we do have a lot of anecdotal information, a lot of books. One that comes to mind that's specific to this state is Gloria Lassen Billings. Her book, Dream Keepers, focuses on people who have done an exceptional job continuously and on an ongoing basis working with low-income African-American children. And I think that she would probably qualify them as warm demanders as well. And so what she basically found and what has been found over and over in terms of people who have replicated these sorts of studies is that these folks had very high expectations in terms of academics. They were good teachers first and foremost. But they also were highly culturally competent, understanding their students' cultural context and what their students needed. And then this aspect of critical consciousness, teaching students to be change agents, to be deep thinkers, and to be critical and to be thinking about how to actually change their world. So there's a lot of books, anecdotal evidence that demonstrates that these warm demanders are very effective teachers, but you know, when teachers are evaluated, they don't check a box that says I'm a warm demander, or they're not characterized as a warm demander. So we're not able to actually see these kind of differences emerge within the data that we typically use for policy decision making.
As the school year begins, we're talking with Dakota Irby about how Wisconsin's public schools could close the achievement gap. Dakota is an assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago, does a lot of research still in Wisconsin. And what do you think, Dakota, that teachers and administrators, especially those who aren't from a minority community, what might they not know about what the experience is like from a kid's perspective?
Well, there's a lot that they don't know, but I found that there's a lot of things that also resonate. So some people may not know what it is to be in my skin, for example. I'm a black male. I identify as black. So they may not know what you know, it means to be in my skin, but many people have experienced feeling humiliated, for example, feeling marginalized. Many people have experiences, a lot of teachers have experiences being poor. It's especially here in the state of Wisconsin, when I work with schools, a lot of times when we talk about experiences of marginalization, a lot of people have poverty and being poor is something that comes to the forefront for them. So there are some ways that teachers and school leaders can and do identify with students who are, you know, underperforming. But then there are some other ways, you know, like I mentioned, race and those sorts of things, English language learners, students who have, you know, who are immigrants, undocumented students. A lot of people don't have the kind of experiences that lend them a particular kind of, like, sensitivity to those kinds of issues. And that's really where a lot of the emphasis on cultural competence and those sorts of things become very important. And I know that our state superintendent of education has made cultural competence and especially an emphasis on racial equity a focus within the state of Wisconsin. And the reason that's probably a focus is because those are the kinds of things that require a lot more attention and conversation if we're to effectively address them.
Now, speaking about developing those sensitivities, one thing that we might have thought worked at one point is centering the curriculum around race-neutral and class-neutral concepts. But you say that that doesn't work. Why not?
It doesn't work because it goes back to this idea of kind of critical consciousness. A huge part of being able to compel young people to perform and get young people to perform is that teachers need to actually be learners too, and be aware of those kinds of racial differences or things that they might not be aware of. There's a whole, you know, I could run down a list of different kinds of so-called race-neutral policies that actually end up having, you know, huge racial implications. Vouchers, charter school movement is one of those. So there's this idea, for example, that, you know, charter schools are going to deal with the issue of race and racial inequities in education. And what we actually see is that the charter schools don't perform any better and in some areas perform worse than the traditional public schools. And so a lot of it is that there's a lot of kind of policies. But, if we go back to Du Bois, if we go back to King, if we go back to a lot of folks, one of the primary issues in this country that we are all too happy to ignore is the issues along lines of race and racism. And they're endemic to American culture, and we're just happy to skip over them. But unless policies are specifically focused on issues of race or gender or immigration status and those sorts of things, they actually, in the long term, have very little effect on being able to change people's hearts and to change policies as well.
As the school year begins here in Wisconsin, we're talking with Dakota Irby about how Wisconsin's public schools could begin to close the achievement gap. Dakota's assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to be done to close this achievement gap in the state, and what do things look like? What's going on in your school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue that conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. As the school year gets going, we're talking now with Dakota Irby about how Wisconsin's public schools could begin to close the achievement gap. Dakota's assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you think Wisconsin can close the achievement gap? What do you think kids need from teachers to succeed if they come from minority groups or disadvantaged backgrounds? If you're a kid from a minority group, what do you want your school to know about you and how you need to learn? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Monica with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Monica.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, I am a retired teacher in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I have been teaching in Milwaukee for 40 years, and one of the things I've noticed that now that I'm working part-time as a substitute is the increase in class size. And I can't, it's just gotten abysmal. I've been in seventh grade classrooms with 55 students. And I know that children build, achieve discipline and self-discipline in part by their relationship with their teacher. And you can't build a relationship when you've got 55 students per class for five class periods a day, you really can't do that. And kids don't relate to somebody they don't know, and they don't use them as an example. And I'd just like your guest to address that. I'm driving in the car, and I need to hang up, but I'd like
understand.
To hear his response.
Sure. Thank you so much, Monica, for that. 55 in a class. I hadn't heard numbers quite like that before. Monica's saying that's some of her experience. But what about those class sizes, Dakota? Is that something we should be taking into account?
Yeah, absolutely. And that goes back to, you know, my initial response to the question of what can be done and talking about different kinds of resources. And so the resources to actually provide enough teachers to have a reasonable teacher-student ratio is critically important, because without that particular resource, the teacher, enough teachers, exactly as your caller mentioned, it undermines the potential for the students to build a kind of relationships. And it also makes teaching more difficult for the teachers as well. So I agree with her. The research bears that out. In my research, I found those similar things. So I would just agree with what she has to say.
So that's a funding issue, right?
Yes.
So you have more money, you can hire more teachers and reduce class sizes.
Well, you know, yeah, if you have, and a lot of it boils down to, you know, political will and decision-making and those sorts of things. You know, budgets are values documents. And just because there's more money doesn't mean that more money gets allocated to things that go directly to classroom instruction and to teachers. So, you know, it's more money, but it's also how is money allocated within the school system. An example is, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, the personnel that are in schools. Milwaukee, for example, I think in 2009 was identified as their middle school students were suspended at the highest rate in the nation. And that's changed over time. And so, you know, the questions that come to mind are like, you know, if are you spending resources on security and school resource officers and that sort of personnel, or do you allocate resources to people who are in the building in an instructional capacity? So a lot of it is about more resources, but also how those resources are allocated.
Well, thank you, Monica. We're going to go next to Paul. Paul joins us from Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Paul.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good.
My comment was that I have a unique perspective in that I'm in Door County now, but I've been teaching for close to 20 years, and I taught in Chicago. And I, this year, make less than 50% of what I did 10 years ago in Chicago, but I'm able to stay in the profession because I don't have a lot of debt. And I think that Wisconsin's gotten to the point now where, for teachers, a lot of it has become about the money, which was never, it was a calling more than anything, because there was an implied living wage, and the reality is now that that's changed.
Paul, thank you for that. And what about teacher salaries, Dakota? Is that something that needs to be factored in?
Yeah, absolutely. Teachers are important. I think that they should be compensated accordingly. It is important. I'm not an expert on that particular area, but it is an important indicator of teacher quality as well as teacher retention and those sorts of things, which, again, is critically important in terms of what students' experiences are in the classroom in terms of the quality of learning that's taking place.
And we know that there is right now a big cultural conversation going on about standardized testing in schools. Could you tell us a little bit about how that plays maybe into the achievement gap and how standardized testing, maybe high-stakes standardized testing, should be handled and maybe framed when it comes to achievement?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things is I like to spend a lot of time on this area because testing has never worked in the favor of oppressed or marginalized groups in society. And if we think specifically about the kind of tests that we use that are related to, like, intelligence and those sorts of things, the roots, the intellectual underpinnings of them were established early in the 20th century, 21st century, excuse me, by scientists who were part of this, what is called the eugenics movement. And the eugenics movement was really a group of scientists, which has largely been discredited now, but it was a group of scientists who basically wanted to link genetics to intellectual kind of ability. As you might imagine, when this emerged in the early, 1907 to 1939 was a huge era for genetic scientists. This was used to justify the mistreatment and the state-sponsored discrimination against people of color, especially African-American people. And so when you hear people talk about the tests are culturally biased and the tests are racist and those sorts of things, a lot of those kind of critiques people make those critiques in the spirit of understanding things like the eugenics movement and where we get things like the IQ test and where we get standardized testing from. They've always been designed to sort and to disadvantage people of color, especially black folks, poor folks, and they really contribute this kind of intellectual underpinnings. And it seems that in today's time, it seems like it's ridiculous to have a science that specifically focused on documenting differences in ability and intelligence based on tests. But that's exactly what happened then, and the intellectual underpinnings remain today. And so, it's a very narrow, the tests are a pretty narrow measure of a person's potential. It's their, it measures their potential for specific types of intelligence. And so I think keeping that in mind is important in light of us creating the kind of school systems that place that associate high stakes with standardized testing. So this is something I could talk about forever. This is a passion area for me. But the standardized testing, high stakes standardized testing, is indeed problematic. Me personally, I never have been a good test taker. I had to take my SAT and ACT several times. Mm-hmm. I graduated with a 2.7 grade point average. And when I went to graduate school, I scored an 18 and a 24, in the 18th and 24th percentile on my graduate record examination. And here today, I'm a professor at the
University of Illinois in Chicago. And I wish we could keep going. So much to talk about. Dakota, thank you so much for joining us.
Yep, thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Dakota Irby, assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago.